This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you all for coming and braving the weather out there. I'm excited to present Dr. George. He's on faculty in head and neck cancer. He did his residency here, went out to MD Anderson in Texas, and came back on faculty here. So it's nice to have him back here and also to talk to us about thyroid disease and thyroid cancer.
Thanks, Jeanette. Hi, everyone here. I appreciate everyone coming out. I realize that there's weather in the area, and thankfully, we got a little open window to have some people come out, so I appreciate everyone coming out. So my talk is about thyroid disease and thyroid cancer. This is a very common and increasingly common problem that predominantly affects more women than men, although it does reach everybody. How many people here know somebody who has some type of thyroid disease, either a friend, relative, or themselves? Great. How about anybody who knows anyone with thyroid cancer? Great. And every once in a while, it comes into the news. Celebrity patients come up in the news having a new diagnosis of thyroid cancer quite often, actually. So without further ado, let's get started. I'll talk briefly. Click here. Okay, so I have nothing to disclose by way of conflicts of interest. Overview here, I'll briefly be talking about the anatomy and physiology of the thyroid gland and endocrine system. Then I'll be talking about specific thyroid diseases, hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism, and then the types of neoplasms. Neoplasms just means growth that can affect the thyroid gland, and these are either benign neoplasms, nodules, so to speak, and then malignant neoplasms, the cancers. And then I'll spend a while talking about advanced thyroid cancers, and then I'll provide a summary. So the endocrine system, brought this up. A lot of people don't know what the word endocrine means, but basically there's a hormone system. And so what does it do? Hormones are chemical signals that are released into the bloodstream. They bind to receptors on target tissues, which are all throughout the body. And they regulate specific body functions. They're important in almost all of your body processes, actually, from digestion, metabolism, breathing, function of the tissues throughout your body, sensory perception, sleep, going to the bathroom, lactating, stress, development, and growth, the way your brain works, the way you move, the way your moods change, and reproductive function as well. So the primary endocrine glands in the brain, you have the hypothalamus and the pituitary in your neck, the thyroid and the parathyroid glands. In your abdomen, you have the adrenal glands, which sit above your kidneys, and then you have pancreas, and then, of course, you have your ovaries and in men, testes. So today we'll be focusing on the thyroid gland. So thyroid gland is a 10 to 20 gram butterfly-shaped gland in your neck. It has two lobes, right and left lobe, and an isthmus, which is this middle section. It sometimes, in about half the cases, has this other little lobe that goes up this way called the pyramidal lobe, and it's surrounded by this fibrous capsule that keeps it in check, which is a pretty flexible, elastic boundary. And it sits right in front of your trachea. So on closer look, it sits literally in front of your trachea. This is your larynx, also known as the voice box. So these are the lobes of the thyroid. These are the muscles for your vocal cords that help you produce sound and pitch of your voice as well. So it's actually really in a very, very important area of the body, considering the vital structures that it's around. The trachea, like I said before, the nerve to the voice box goes literally right underneath the thyroid gland and is sometimes involved with thyroid diseases, thyroid cancers, and can be inadvertently injured in thyroid surgery, but can also be intentionally removed in the case of removing cancers. The thyroid is bounded on either side by both your carotid artery and your jugular vein, which everybody knows are major important vascular structures. Your esophagus is right behind your trachea, and the parathyroid glands are these very, very tiny glands that you have four of, and those sit on the back of the thyroid, two on each side. So you have a right superior and inferior parathyroid gland, and you have a left superior and inferior parathyroid gland. I'm not talking about the parathyroid glands today, but they're really important in monitoring your and controlling your body's calcium function. So this is what it actually more likely would look, just from a drawing. Intraoperatively, you have all these veins. It's a very heavily vascularized organ. It gets a major amount of blood from your heart in order to produce its thyroid hormone and send that throughout the body. So it's heavily vascularized, and you can see that it sits between the carotid artery and jugular vein on both sides. This view is just looking at all the various important structures that are in, around, in front of, behind, below, and above the thyroid gland with respect to the trachea, the larynx, and the neck. So I'm not going to go through what all these are. It's just more to demonstrate that this is really a critical area and very important for a number of functions. So the anatomy of the thyroid, actually, is very important to understand the anatomy of the larynx, because if you are to help a patient with thyroid disease, you need to understand the innervation to the larynx, because nerves tend to be very, very small. And when you take out a thyroid, you need to individually identify all the nerves to the voice box. And these run underneath the thyroid. So the thyroid would sit roughly right about here. This is known as the recurrent laryngeal nerve. It's the primary nerve for your voice. On each side, you have two of them. If you have just one of the two out, you can have significant hoarseness, difficulty swallowing as well. And then this nerve, the recurrent, controls your body's primary, the main vocal motion of your vocal cord, and these nerves up here control the pitch of your voice box. So this is just to show that you can have significant effects on your voice from thyroid disease and thyroid surgery. So the microanatomy, this is what thyroid looks like under a microscope. Thyroid gland is composed of millions of these little tiny follicles, and these are thyroid cells, this single layer of thyroid, what's called epithelium. In this area are the capillaries from your own bloodstream going into the thyroid, and then you have the single layer of thyroid follicles of these tiny little thyroid cells, and then in here is basically a giant lake of thyroid hormone that's bound in proteins. Great. And so the thyroid cells are predominantly in charge of thyroid hormone synthesis. What they do is they take iodine in from your bloodstream via eating leafy green vegetables and other things. They take the iodine in from that, they produce thyroid hormone, and then they secrete that out into your body or store it in what's called the lumen. So like I said, they absorb iodine from your body. The cells of the thyroid have this sodium iodine symporter, which is this very important molecule that allows it to take up iodine and convert it from iodine itself into a very important chemical reaction into what's called T4 and T3, and those are the primary thyroid hormones. And then it either stores them in the lumen or it sends them back out into the body as T4, where they go to their target tissues and they are converted into T3, which is the active form. So they come into the thyroid cell, the follicular cell, as iodine, and they're transported into a 3-iodine molecule. Sorry, they're turned into a 4-iodine molecule, which is called thyroxine, which is then either stored in the lumen or it's sent out back into your body to circulate around your body as T4, and then when it hits the target tissue, it's turned into T3, which is its active form. So T3 and T4. T4 is the form that's stored by, sorry, that's formed by the thyroid, and T3 is the form that is active. The main function, like I said, is to regulate the body's metabolism. And the thyroid releases T4 and it's converted into T3 in other organs. So the T3 interacts with the receptors and is the active form, and that induces receptors in the body's target tissue to change their genetic makeup. Which actually affects their tissues. So can anyone here guess which one of these is the T3 and which is the T4 form of the thyroid hormone, sir? Anybody? This has, so it's amount, the number of iodines, basically. So it's a what's that?
Bottom's T4.
Yeah, bottom's T4, exactly. So these are based on tyrosine, which is amino acid. The molecule with 3 iodines is the T3. It's the active form. And then the 4-iodinated molecule is the T4 version, which is inactive, which has a much longer half-life circulating around the body. And so that's why it did. Basically this is the storage form, and then this is the active form. So this is another look at the thyroid follicle cell. And just, I'm not going to go through these reactions, but this is iodine coming in, being converted into T3 and T4, and then being kept in this lake or lumen, and then for storage. And it's secreted also out into the blood as T4 and converted into T3. So how is the thyroid function regulated? It's actually regulated by the brain. The hypothalamus releases something called TRH, and that affects the pituitary. TRH is thyrotropin-releasing hormone that essentially the brain sends a signal to the pituitary to activate the pituitary's release of what's called TSH. And TSH is probably the most important endocrine signaling hormone other than T3 and T4, because that is that's the molecule released by the pituitary that acts on the thyroid to make it release more thyroid hormone or grow. So it's basically a trophic hormone, which means to make something grow. And that allows it to secrete more T3 and T4. So this is essentially one of the most important parts here is this negative feedback loop. If thyroid hormone is put out in excess by the thyroid gland, it circulates throughout the body, but then it goes back to the brain to tell the brain to stop putting out more TRH, which is acting on the pituitary. So the laboratory test of thyroid function is the TSH. And if TSH is low, that means your thyroid is too active. If TSH is high, it means your thyroid is underactive. So thyroid hormone affects pretty much every single cell and organ in your body. I'll just go through these in a minute, but basically you can imagine all the effects it has. It promotes fetal and childhood growth and development. In the heart, it controls your heart rate, the contractility of your heart muscle, and the output of the blood flow from your heart. Controls the effect of the brain, the base of the brain on the ventilation, or essentially how much you're breathing, which affects the amount of oxygen and carbon dioxide in your blood. Your basal resting body energy expenditure, heat generation within your body, and your weight, which is related to your fat and carbohydrate metabolism, your bone metabolism as well, and then your GI motility and renal water clearance. So you can tell by the number of systems it affects how widespread the symptoms would be from either overactivation or underactivation of thyroid function. So one important area is on your heart. It affects your heart's rate, like I said, and the strength of your heart and muscle, the cardiac output and peripheral vascular resistance. So that's the resistance of the rest of your blood vessels in your body and how tightly they're squeezing to increase your blood pressure in kind of a fight or flight response. So thyroid, there's a big role of thyroid function in aging. As with most organ systems in aging, there is a relative decline in function. Thyroid labs don't necessarily change over time with aging. They stay pretty much the same, unless, of course, you actually have thyroid dysfunction. So overall, the thyroid labs remain the same unless you have some form of dysfunction. But thyroid disease does go up as patients age. Prevalence of low thyroid function or hypothyroidism is 2 to 7%. Subclinical hypothyroidism, which is just laboratory values only, and actually you're feeling okay, no clinical symptoms, is 6 to 13%. And patients with hyperthyroidism is much less common, which is 2%. So hyperthyroidism is overproduction of thyroid hormone, which would produce more T3, T4, and would result in a lower TSH. Hypothyroidism is underproduction of thyroid hormone, which would result in a high TSH. And of course, the other types of disorders are the neoplastic processes, and we'll go through this later. Can anyone tell me what this is a picture of? Is this hyper or hypothyroidism? Somebody who?
Hyper.
Hyper, correct. Anyone know the name of the disorder? It's called Graves' disease, and I'll go through that in a little bit. So like I said, a biochemical evaluation of your labs, TSH high is hypothyroidism, and TSH being low is hyperthyroidism. And so when hyper, your metabolism speeds up, and in hypothyroidism, the metabolism would slow down, along with the concordant body functions associated with that, like your heart and your GI tract. So hyperthyroidism affects over 2 million Americans. Women are predominantly affected. Patients who are elderly are more affected than not. And the examples that are the most common causes are Graves' disease and an active or toxic goiter, multinodular goiter, which is active. So these often come up. This is Barbara Bush, who was diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, who was treated. And then I looked at these pictures. I downloaded them from the internet, and I looked at them, and I actually can't tell much of a difference between her face. She looks beautiful here and beautiful here. I see the difference in terms of some things, but in any case, this is just one example of a celebrity who had a hyperthyroidism that was treated successfully. So clinical presentation usually affects the most vulnerable organ, which is often the heart or the brain, neuropsychiatric syndromes, symptoms. So nonspecific symptoms are often weight loss despite increased appetite. So patients may eat more, but they tend to lose weight. And then when they see their doctor, they have an increased heart rate, maybe some arrhythmia, and maybe some heart difficulty that develops over time. And they can also develop muscle weakness and muscle wasting. So signs and symptoms of hyperthyroidism: nervousness, irritability, difficulty sleeping. Patients who often have diarrhea or loose stools, warm, moist skin, and sweating. They can have excessive vomiting in pregnancy. Their voice can become more hoarse or deeper. They may develop a dry or sore throat. And some of these are related to local effects of a larger thyroid gland on the neck, like difficulty swallowing. But of course, like I said, they can have a rapid or regular heartbeat. It can lead to infertility. It can certainly affect the developing fetus. And it can also cause these things that I mentioned: weight loss, heat intolerance, sweating. And then you can have miscarriage as well. Okay, so treatment of hyperthyroidism really relates to controlling the primary symptoms on the target end organs. So beta blockers are drugs that block your heart rate, and one of the primary causes of primary symptoms of signs of hyperthyroidism is an elevated heart rate. So beta blockers would control that. And then the overall treatment goal is to reduce the synthesis and release of other thyroid hormone. And so you can have drugs that actually affect and target the thyroid to shut it down, like methimazole and propylthiouracil, or you can give radioactive iodine, which is iodine connected to a radioactive molecule, which is taken up by the thyroid cells specifically, and then it kills the thyroid cells, so essentially shrinks and decreases the function of your thyroid gland. And then finally, of course, you can offer surgery to remove not all, but most of the thyroid gland to reduce their thyroid function. And then if they become hypothyroid after that, you can make up the difference with thyroid hormone supplementation. So Graves' disease is one of the most common causes of hyperthyroidism. It basically is a reduction in thyroid function. You have a lot of production of thyroid hormone, which acts on other parts of the body. So it's hyperthyroidism. The thyroid grows very large, and then you have these thyroid receptors throughout the body. There are some receptors. I'm not explaining this very clearly, but these are antibodies to thyroid hormone receptors that attack areas in your body, such as the eye. So you have thyroid hormone receptors in the eye, and these antibodies attack those areas and can cause your eyes essentially to become hypertrophic or larger. So the eye muscles get larger, they swell up, and they start coming literally out of your head in conjunction with having hyperthyroidism and symptoms associated with that. So this is a pretty striking example of a patient with Graves' disease. You can see, and most patients, you can't see a space between the upper part of their sclera here, and you can't see this exposed area of the cornea. And with patients with Graves' disease, their eyes muscles are so swollen that they're being pushed out of their eye socket. So the peak incidence of Graves' disease, 20 to 40 years old, females to males, 7-to-1 ratio. And this is an autoimmune disorder where the antibodies against the TSH receptor, there are some in the eye, unfortunately, and this causes the eye connective tissue to get enlarged and the eyes bulge outward. And this, you don't see this very often. This is pretty easily diagnosed, and it's one of the most common and enjoyable things in medical school to learn about. But because so many people know about it, you don't see patients walking around with Graves' disease that much, because it's readily treated. And this is another example. This patient's not able to follow movement of the hand because of the eye muscles being fixed in position. Another example. The reason he looks abnormal, other than having a goiter, which you probably can't see given the lighting, but he does have thyroid enlargement here, is that you normally don't see a patient, the whites of their eyes above and below their sclera, their cornea. So you don't see this part of the white, this white part of the sclera. And in this patient, what she has is a depression of her left eye, because asymmetric bulging that's pushing her left eye down, and this eye is being pushed outward. And the same thing, but even more pronounced in this patient. So moving on to hypothyroidism, this is a hidden health problem. It affects up to 25 million Americans. The problem is actually that roughly 12 million are undiagnosed, are clinically symptomatic but don't actually know it. And this is not the subclinical form where patients don't have symptoms. This is the symptomatic hypothyroidism with lab abnormalities. And this is most commonly due to chronic autoimmune thyroiditis, and that is the silent attacking of the thyroid gland by the body's own immune system, which is much more common in women, 10 times more common in women, where the body's antibodies of the immune system attack the thyroid for unknown reasons, and that can lead to a progressive dysfunction of thyroid function and a progressive lowering of thyroid hormone release. So patients do over time develop hypothyroidism. Initially, you get these vague symptoms, this fatigue, this weakness, this there's a mood disturbance that patients get, and they don't know why, and they deal with that for many, many years. And it doesn't necessarily show up as an abnormal lab value at first. And that's subclinical. Okay, so hypothyroidism is very important because it affects multiple body systems, and it can be very harmful to your health, actually, in many ways. Like hyperthyroidism can affect your heart and your GI tract and your mind. Hypothyroidism can lead to decreased function of your heart, decreased oxygen uptake, and decreased GI function as well. So it can slow your heart, it can cause fluid to develop around your heart, and it can reduce your heart, your cardiac output. In your mind and brain, it leads to lethargy, fatigue, sleep disturbances. You can sleep for 10 hours a day and not actually and wake up without feeling rested, and then need naps throughout the day. Patients have significant sleep disturbances. Also, it affects your cognition, your concentration as well, and it can lead to depression. Okay, so signs and symptoms in multiple body systems affected. It can affect your liver, can lead to increased cholesterol. It can cause constipation, slowing of the GI tract. It can decrease your fertility. In your mind and brain, it can reduce your concentration and lead to essentially apathy and depression. And then it can decrease your heart rate and your cardiac contractility. And then it can also cause fluid retention by affecting your kidneys. So you take on more water weight. So I went through these. This is just a mnemonic to go through. It's sluggish. So sleepiness, loss of memory, unusually dry skin, goiter or enlarged thyroid. And what that is basically your thyroid's function is decreasing, and so your brain is sending more TSH to stimulate your thyroid to grow, so it's growing more, so that's what a goiter is. A gradual personality change, increase in weight, sensitivity to cold, and then thinning of the hair. So in the treatment for hypothyroidism is levothyroxine. There are a lot of other ways to treat. I'm sure there's natural remedies as well for subclinical hypothyroidism, but for actually clinically significant hypothyroidism, the treatment is levothyroxine. This was discovered from extracts of hog thyroid glands at Mayo Clinic in 1914, and prior to that, and throughout the Middle Ages, throughout the early centuries, patients would die of hypothyroidism. So after thyroid surgery came about for goiter, where patients had essentially airway compression from their goiter, thyroid surgery was developed, patients would have their thyroid glands removed, but then they would die of hypothyroidism. So then, until that happened, there was obviously a significant health impact, and then when levothyroxine was found at Mayo Clinic, and then it was synthesized in Britain. Patients started actually being able to undergo successful thyroid surgery with thyroid hormone replacement and then have a normal life after that. So it's the most commonly prescribed medication in the United States with nearly 25 million prescriptions a year, and it's listed on the World Health Organization list of essential medicines. So these are outcomes after patients treated for hypothyroidism. This is what a hypothyroid patient may look like. Relatively puffy compared to her post-treatment, but relatively puffy cheeks, lagging eyelids, more of an apathetic gaze, and maybe here she's more active. It has less fluid retention in her skin, less puffy eyelids. This is another example of a patient with hypothyroidism and then following treatment for hypothyroidism, different facial appearance. So it's significant, the impacts it can have. So subclinical hypothyroidism is patients who have no clinical symptoms. They have may have vague symptoms. It's not overtly clinically impactful, but they have abnormal laboratory values. So a high TSH with a normal thyroid hormone floating around. They have vague symptoms such as fatigue, sleep disturbance, and mild cognitive impairment. And the cause of this is often, like I said before, is autoimmune thyroiditis. So the body's immune system can affect the thyroid function. And this is the prevalence in women over 60 is 20%, so the subclinical hypothyroidism. This is often not treated with medications, and physicians are often treating laboratory values in an asymptomatic patient. But treatment is recommended for patients who are significantly hypothyroid, and that's a TSH of greater than 10, where they have signs or symptoms or they have a family history of thyroid disease. Going a little further into Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Hashimoto's thyroiditis is this chronic lymphocytic thyroiditis. It's the same thing. This is where the body's immune system is attacking the thyroid. I see this quite significantly on patients' pathology, actually, for after thyroid surgery. It will be in the background of their thyroid. It'll say lymphocytic thyroiditis. And women are 10 times more likely to have this. And the antibodies in the body are attacking this thyroid peroxidase molecule, and this is found in 90% of patients, and you can actually get that as a lab test. Patients often have a family history of this. Their average age is 60, and what happens is their thyroid over time gradually fails to function because these are all lymphocytes, these dark cells. They are essentially coming in, they're attacking the TPO molecule, and they're causing gradual destruction of the thyroid gland, and that leads to a slow progression of hypothyroidism. So just now, take a quick break. Does anyone have any questions? I know I'm going at a lightning speed. Yeah.
If one's being treated as an adolescent for, I don't know if it was hyper or hypo, does it mean that you should watch it the rest of your life?
So the question is, if one has been treated for hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism, would you be followed for that problem? And the answer is yes, certainly. So in almost all cases of a patient having been treated for hyper or hypothyroidism, you'd have your labs checked and your thyroid hormone dose adjusted. Or if it's hyperthyroidism and you're treated with, say, radioactive iodine, you'd still have your labs checked for that. So the labs that they check are TSH, T4, and T3. In most women and men over 50, these should be pretty much annually checked labs for everybody here who's over 50.
Is that this part of the medical yearly checkup and blood test?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So primary doctors and family doctors and all types of physicians who do primary care would be checking thyroid function tests and at the TSH, T4, and T3.
Thank you.
Sure. Should I go on? Oh, go ahead.
You said that in some cases you remove the thyroid completely. You then replace with hormone?
Mm-hmm. So I would talk in the second part about complete removal of the thyroid. Removal for hyperthyroidism is usually subtotal. So you leave some form, some part of the thyroid there, usually the most normal looking on ultrasound, the one with the least nodules. And then you would follow up with the check of how their labs look, and you would supplement them if they need it.
Okay.
Any other thoughts or questions? Yes. Are you thinking of hypothyroidism?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the symptoms start off vague often. So it's usually decreased energy, increased fatigue, your bowel symptoms may happen later. So certain symptoms may happen later. I'd say that the cognitive symptoms, the sleep symptoms tend to happen earlier, the mood symptoms earlier, symptoms affecting the heart, affecting the GI tract, usually are later symptoms. And the same would go for hyperthyroidism as well. So I have patients with hyperthyroidism who have anxiety, panic attacks, sleeplessness, but they don't necessarily have tachycardia yet or diarrhea. So any other? Yes. Yeah, that's a really complex issue for sure. I don't believe that. What's that? Oh, yeah, so I have to repeat the question. The question is, with respect to menopause, which has effects on body tissues like the bones and other organ tissues, so what is the relationship, essentially, of thyroid function on that? And I'm not sure that's quite clear. I know that thyroid function doesn't necessarily change with menopause, but thyroid function can certainly cause things like osteoporosis. So patients who either are hyperthyroid or have way too much thyroid hormone supplementation, that can lead to osteoporosis over time, which I think is a different contributor to osteoporosis than menopause. So I think I'd have to defer to my OBGYN colleagues with respect to understanding how menopause relates to thyroid function, because we don't really see that often that patients in or post-menopause are having a new change in thyroid function that leads to end organ problems like osteoporosis. So it's definitely a complex issue, but I don't see it that commonly. I don't think endocrinologists see it that commonly that the thyroid is directly affected by menopause, but I'm sure there are effects. Anyone else for now? Sure. Hyperthyroidism, most common cause is often Graves' disease, endogenous production. Yeah. Okay, anyone else for now? Great, we'll go on. Good, okay, so now talking about thyroid neoplasms. Neoplasm is just a fancy word for growth, and neoplasm can either be where the tissue is growing and the cells are normal, or where the tissue is growing and the cells, the nuclei, are abnormal, and that leads to them taking on characteristics of invasion locally and spreading distantly, and that's cancer. So for a benign thyroid neoplasm in the thyroid, is a goiter or a simple adenoma, and the malignant is thyroid cancer, and I'll go through those. So benign goiters are usually caused by a dietary iodine deficiency. They're more often seen in other countries throughout the world than they are in the U.S., We still do see them, of course, and they're caused by impaired synthesis of thyroid hormone because your body doesn't have enough dietary iodine, so it can't produce enough thyroid hormone. That leads to barely noticeable, and more on my screen, but barely noticeable thyroid gland enlargement. I think to a trained eye, you can see this pretty easily, but oftentimes patients don't even notice it themselves in their own mirror, when they look at the mirror and somebody else either feels their neck or looks at something abnormal, and that's what brings them to diagnosis and workup. And the impaired synthesis of thyroid hormone causes the brain to produce more TSH, which stimulates the growth of the thyroid gland. And this patient does have a more remarkable thyroid enlargement. What that does is hyperplasia and hypertrophy. This is essentially increase in the number of cells and increase in the growth of each cell. And it's not necessarily symmetric. So this is a patient with an asymmetric thyroid goiter. This probably doesn't even involve the left side because you can see that the midline of the patient is here. The patient's left thyroid gland may be totally normal, and this is an outgrowth of the thyroid gland on the right side. These patients may be euthyroid, so their labs may actually be normal, despite having a TSH that over time causes increasing growth in the thyroid gland. They may still have normal thyroid labs, and that's actually often the case. I think that's just because of compensatory function, compensatory compensation within the thyroid that leads to labs being normal. So this is a patient with a really remarkable thyroid goiter. There's obviously bilateral on both sides of the neck, extending down over the sternum, down into on top of the chest. So this is anterior to the sternum or chest wall. So two types of benign goiter are endemic, which is related to geographic region, and that's iodine deficiency related, and sporadic. Sporadic is rare, and for the purposes of this conversation, I won't discuss that. Endemic goiter is not that uncommon, but it's more common in throughout the world. In mountainous areas where there's less iodine, like the Alps, Himalayas, and Andes, inland China and Africa, these are significantly deficient in iodine areas, and you get patients with not uncommonly very, very large thyroids. And a lot of medical trips, surgical trips and whatnot go from the U.S. and other countries to these areas to provide surgical care and post-op management and medical care as well for patients like this. So this is often, as you can imagine, mistaken for a cancer. It's like I said before, it's asymmetrically enlarged and is usually not necessarily acted upon unless it has mass effect. So mass effect, as you can imagine, this very, very large gland causes dysphagia, which is difficulty swallowing. It can cause compression of your of the vessels in your neck, which can lead your head to swell up, and it can cause airway obstruction. This is a CT in cross-section, and this is the patient's left side. This is their left thyroid lobe, which pushes the trachea to the right. And as you can see, these are the clavicles and these are the lungs. It dives down into the sternum. So this is behind the sternum, retrosternal goiter. In this picture, this is an X-ray of a patient with the same thing. Although you know, this is the goiter. Actually, you can't really see the goiter, but you can see the trachea, which is displaced to the patient's right. I bet you this patient would not have really any symptoms from this other than some possibly swallowing difficulty, but it usually would not cause airway difficulty because it's a slow, gradual progression in growth, which doesn't necessarily lead to change in airway in airway function. You can see this gentleman has a significant bilateral goiter. His right side pushes out almost up to his chin. Sometimes these can go up underneath the neck to the skull base and down into the chest. And when they're removed, you get a multinodular, pretty gross appearance, but these are small nodules, and internally they have bled within them, so it's a non-functional nodule. All these nodules are usually non-functional, but they're just taking up space in the patient's body. So that's benign goiter. Anybody have any questions about that for now? Okay, I'll move on. We can ask questions later. Thyroid cancer. So solitary thyroid nodules, you have to more consistently think about cancer. A multinodular goiter on ultrasound, which is the most common workup for them, will have multiple nodules all throughout the thyroid, whereas a single solitary thyroid nodule in 85% of cases is benign, but in 15% of cases can be cancer. And so we have to think about cancer as a possibility. And I'll go into these. The most common type of cancer is papillary thyroid cancer. It has the best outcomes. Less common, but also with good outcomes, is called follicular thyroid cancer. And rare types of much more highly aggressive cancers are medullary thyroid cancer and anaplastic. So these are based on the histology of the cancer. So the aggressiveness is based on how well differentiated the cells look under a microscope. Differentiation is basically how mature a cell looks and how organized everything looks. If it's organized and everything looks normal, it's called differentiated, meaning it looks as it should. And those thyroid cancers tend to behave well, and they tend to be curable and have high survival rates. And those are papillary and follicular. The more poorly differentiated types of cancers have much more varied appearances. Their nuclei are all over the place. There's disorganization throughout the tissue when you look at it under a microscope. The cells are invading through blood vessels. They're going into lymph structures through capsules, so they don't really respect the normal boundaries of the structures they're around. And those are more poorly differentiated examples are anaplastic and medullary. There are others, but those are the primary ones we can discuss. One interesting area is radiation exposure and its relationship to thyroid cancer. Ionizing radiation significantly can increase the likelihood of thyroid cancer, and it's more harmful on younger people. So children, so people under 20 in the first 2 decades of life, are much more likely to develop thyroid cancer. Up to 10 to 40% can develop thyroid cancer when they receive ionizing radiation. That can be from exposure to major accidents, such as the Chernobyl they're not accidents, but Hiroshima Nagasaki incidents, or if patients are young and they develop something like Hodgkin's lymphoma and have to, for their own treatment, receive radiation to the head and neck, they're much more likely later to be to develop thyroid cancer. And actually, prophylactic thyroidectomy, which means removing the thyroid in those patients, even in the absence of any problem, is often recommended to prevent the development of thyroid cancer later, just because it's so much more likely. And of course, the patients, people who survive these disasters, have significantly increased thyroid cancer rates. I have a friend who, when she was 4, she was treated with radiation to prevent tonsillitis in a clinical trial at University of Chicago down back in, I think, the 50s. It was really a radiation misadventure, and she spent the rest of her life fighting off essentially multiply recurrent cancers. These weren't thyroid cancers. Her sister, who was part of the same study, developed multiply recurrent thyroid cancer and survived, but she developed oral cavity cancers and ultimately died from those. But they're certainly related to radiation. So radiation can cause 10 to 20 to 30 or 40 years down the road can cause other types of cancer to develop, and the thyroid is significantly sensitive to those harmful effects. So papillary thyroid cancer is the most common type of thyroid cancer. It makes up 80% of thyroid cancer diagnoses. Has a 3-to-1 female-to-male preponderance. It has the best prognosis overall, so the 10-year disease-specific survival from papillary thyroid cancer is 95%. So that means the percentage of patients alive 10 years after they were diagnosed alive with their thyroid from their thyroid cancer is 95%. But 5% of patients do have dysmetastasis on diagnosis. So it has taken on this reputation of being a relatively good cancer to have, but in some cases it's not. And so all cancers need to be taken seriously until they're proven to not be serious. So there are poor prognosis variants, and these may be the variants that are associated with the more aggressive features and the distant metastasis, and that these are characterized by the types of cells that they have when a doctor looks at them under the microscope. Tall cell, diffuse sclerosing, and columnar. You don't need a memory of these, but these are associated with early invasion, large tumor sizes, and the spread of the disease throughout the patient's body. Follicular thyroid cancers make up 10 to 15%, and they have a lower survival rate than papillary thyroid cancer, but not a much lower survival, roughly 85% survive at 10 years out from the disease. And that number, that 10 years, is just a way of looking at and comparing the survivals from various types of cancer. So this is old data, but 2014 data on differentiated thyroid cancer, so DTC going forward is the type of cancer, papillary and follicular. Incidence 2014, 62,000 new cases, almost 63,000. But the incidence is on the rise, and it's on the rise most significantly in women. So in 2010, there were 45,000 new cases a year diagnosed in America, predicted in 2020 to be 92,000, and predicted in 2030 to be 183,000 new cases a year. And that's, as you can see, men increasing, but women increasing most significantly. So, and that's not understood. And I'll go through that just briefly in a little bit, but at least a small part of that has to do with the increase in the use of mechanisms to look for it. So increase in ultrasound and screening. And I'll talk about that briefly with respect to Korea's increases in their diagnoses. So the peak age of diagnosis is roughly 40 to 55 years of age. You can see this nice unimodal distribution. Patients in middle age have a more frequent diagnosis of thyroid cancer than necessarily patients at older ages. These patients fare worse if they're diagnosed with thyroid cancer. these patients are more consistently diagnosed with it, and young patients do quite well, in part because they're more responsive to radioactive iodine when it's given after the treatment. So thyroid cancer incidence, which means how many cases a year are found and diagnosed, is increasing as it looks here. Women's incidence is increasing more. That's not understood. And the mortality roughly is the same, though. Okay, so the five-year survival, like I said before, is high, 95 to 98%. But the issue is recurrence remains a problem. Patients, this is a study down here that lasted over 30 years. So the issue is that it's not necessarily an aggressive disease, and you can be well treated, but it can come back and recur later. That doesn't necessarily mean that you will die from your disease. It just means that you may have more episodes of having other surgeries later. So recurrence remains a problem. Up to 40% of patients can develop recurrence. This is a study of roughly almost 3,000 patients over 30 years. So it's a very significant number of people, who 30% of whom developed a recurrence of their disease. And that usually shows up as a lymph node in the neck. Whereas mortality was 9%, and that's pretty consistent with what it is. So the incidence of thyroid cancer is increasing worldwide. There's been a 15-fold increase in Korea, and this is from New England Journal of Medicine, showing the incidence of thyroid cancer increasing over time. But the issue with this is at the same time there's been a screening increase as well. So this is a Spearman's or correlative graph, which shows essentially a straight line, which means a direct correlation between the increase in diagnosis and the increase in screening. That doesn't mean causation. Doesn't mean you look for it and therefore it happens. It just means that it may be there and therefore looking for it has found it. So, but like I said before on this slide, the jury is still out whether or not it's actually increasing in terms of overall cause. So myths for thyroid cancer, one myth is that it's a benign malignancy or a malignancy that isn't that big a deal. Another myth is that it seldom recurs. Another myth is that it's easily managed with just, that the recurrences are easily managed with surgery or radioactive iodine, and that it has minimal survival impact. And so a lot of the people in the population think these things, and these are definitely myths. Unfortunately, the mortality is 10 to 20%. Mortality from thyroid cancer is an ugly, ugly disease. It's an ugly problem. Patients who have recurrence in the neck, it can invade their local structures like their trachea, their esophagus, and their larynx. And 36 to 80% of deaths from thyroid cancer are secondary to uncontrolled disease that's in the neck. So basically unresectable disease in the neck that can spread to the spine, it can spread to these important structures, and it can engulf the carotid artery and cause essentially not a very pretty picture. So it's one of the worst in that case. So there's a quote from Helmut Geppert, who's a father of modern head and neck surgery. The indolent behavior of most differentiated thyroid cancers may have physicians and patients, mind you, more afraid of potential complications of extensive thyroid treatment then be mindful of the cancer itself. So the risk group stratification in thyroid cancer, it's either you have the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good patients have low risk because they have early disease with good disease control, with normal surgery and good survival. You have patients with intermediate risk who have a disease that's pretty well controlled and that have reasonable survival. And then high-risk patients, you know, usually up front, they have poor disease control and poor survival, and they're disease progresses at a much faster pace than the other patients. So low-risk disease, there is not uncommonly a patient's residual cancer after initial surgery, but these patients do well. They receive radioactive iodine, and they have good disease control and good survival. Intermediate risk is patients where the thyroid cancer is just barely coming out of the thyroid, or they may have a few metastases to neck lymph nodes. And these patients tend to do reasonably well. And then high-risk patients are where the thyroid on initial presentation is coming out, the cancer is coming out of the thyroid grossly. It can be invading local structures where the tumor is not completely removed by the surgeon initially. or where on presentation the patients have metaseg disease up front. And so this is the staging for thyroid cancer, one of the only cancers that's staged with respect to age. Patients under 45 years with any type of disease are stage one if they have no distant metastasis, and they're stage two if they have distant metastasis. And then, of course, over 45 years, staging it was related to tumor, node, and metastasis, and staging these patients often is most heavily affected by the whether they have had lymph nodes spread of their cancer out into their neck lymph nodes. And so this is a brief picture. I won't go through this, but this is a picture of the neck lymph nodes. There are thousands of lymph nodes in the neck. Thyroid cancer has multiple drainage pathways. It goes laterally to the side of the neck, centrally to the middle of the neck, behind the throat, down into the chest. So there are a lot of lymph node pathways for spread of thyroid cancers. And so lymph node spread is a significant predictor of how patients are going to do overall in terms of survival and recurrence. So how is thyroid cancer worked up? Usually ultrasound is the primary modality. It's the most sensitive modality for thyroid cancer investigation, and that the others are less sensitive and are only used in more advanced disease. So this is my mentor from UCSF, who's now at Stanford. She wrote the book on head and neck ultrasonography, but she paved the way for ultrasound to be used as a primary modality in head and neck and thyroid cancer. So this is recommended by the American Thyroid Association guidelines, routine use for thyroid workup, along with basically for staging. A negative ultrasound, which means there's no evidence of findings of cancer on the ultrasound, predicts excellent long-term survival. So locally advanced thyroid cancer, what actually impacts their life? Their local recurrence usually is the most impactful cause of death, and they can often die from lung or bone, brain, or liver metastases, but less significantly than locally. So lung metastasis is the most distant site of metastasis for thyroid cancer, but local recurrence in the neck is the most common cause of patients perishing from thyroid cancer. So the management goals in thyroid cancer are to remove it, usually through total thyroidectomy. Patients get postoperative radioactive iodine. Then they receive levothyroxine to suppress their TSH. So what the brain does after the thyroid is removed is the brain produces more TSH to make up for what the thyroid was doing before. So what physicians do is they give a higher dose of levothyroxine to tell the brain to turn down its release of TSH, and so the TSH doesn't have the ability to go out into the body and stimulate the growth of cancer cells. Does that make sense? So TSH stimulates thyroid to grow everywhere, whether it's the thyroid gland itself or thyroid cancer. So the way you can suppress the growth of thyroid cancer over time is by giving the patient higher doses of levothyroxine so the TSH is really low, so that the brain isn't telling thyroid cells throughout the body to grow and come back. In select cases, you can give radiation therapy, and patients with distant metastatic disease, you can use chemotherapy. Long-term surveillance is checking their lab values every 6 months, and what you look for is the TG. The TG is thyroglobulin, which is the protein that's used to bind the thyroid molecule T3 and T4. And if you remove all the thyroid tissue, the TG essentially should go down to zero. So as you guys know, a PSA is the prostate hormone, which essentially you can check throughout your life. And if you have prostate cancer and it's treated, your PSA should stay low. And if it goes up over time, that's when you look for a recurrence. Well, the same thing applies here. A TG should be low after thyroid surgery. And if it continues to rise, then you start looking for it having come back in the body. And then, of course, repeated ultrasounds are important. So we have an endocrine conference here at UCSF to discuss advanced thyroid cancers that's comprised of surgeons, endocrinologists, radiologists, pathologists, and radiation and medical oncologists. And so that's just a comprehensive multidisciplinary care for thyroid cancer. So briefly looking, I think I have some minutes, briefly looking at surgical resection for thyroid cancer. It's the mainstay of thyroid cancer treatment is surgery followed by radioactive iodine if necessary. So patients, you have a thyroidectomy, whether total or partial, and then with or without neck dissection if lymph nodes are involved. And then you essentially set the patient up for lifelong of surveillance for recurrence. So they undergo ultrasound. They can have neck exams by their doctor. And then, of course, lab evaluations for the thyroglobulin or TG. So these are, this is essentially just briefly going through what locally invasive thyroid cancer looks like. RLN is recurrent laryngeal nerve, and that's the nerve to the voice box that goes right underneath the thyroid. That's probably the most significantly, the most commonly invaded area by thyroid cancers. That's right back here, and the nerve to the voice box can quite often be invaded by thyroid cancer coming out of the thyroid. And the nerve has to be taken and the voice reconstructed at a later date. So in invasion of the larynx, trachea, and esophagus, you have to radically resect all the thyroid cancer in order to ensure the patient's survival. An incomplete resection has a high rate of local relapse and decreased survival. I have a 30-year-old patient who is a waiter here in San Francisco, just presented last week with hoarseness and difficulty swallowing and some coughing, not knowing what's happening. His friend noticed a neck mass. He hadn't really paid attention to it. And then he comes to someone like myself, who does the right, workup, ultrasound, CT, MRI, finding a neck mass, essentially a thyroid mass invading the larynx, voice box, and then you have to tell a patient you have to remove the voice box, and they're only 30 years old, and they're a waiter, and they had all these plans. So it's pretty impactful, and it affects young people, and it's a significant problem, and it's very hard to counsel patients when they just came to you and they had a normal life before they saw you and you're the bearer of bad news. But it's a serious issue and you have to bring them to the same level of understanding of how serious it is. So this is how to manage patients when they have just focal tracheal involvement. So the thyroid cancer can have just invaded the trachea, which you can very nicely excise and put back together. This is an example of a thyroid cancer that's invading. This is the airway here. This is the cancer coming into the airway from right here. In these cases, you remove the trachea. The thyroid is gone as well. The larynx is up here. Voice box still works. The nerves to the voice box are fully intact. And you can use various reconstructive techniques to reconstruct it. You can't remove the whole voice box and make a new voice box, but you can use various parts of the body called free flaps to reproduce swallowing function and later at a later date reproduce voice function. So this is a forearm free flap that is put in place of the trachea and is sewn in place. And when you look down the patient's airway, you can see this is the arm skin. And this is the back of the trachea, and the patient's able to breathe. And this is essentially an example of the same, but a different type of resection of the trachea where you have to remove the whole trachea, kind of like the cylindrical portion. You remove it, and it looks like this after you've removed it. So the voice box is up here. This is the trachea. The voice box fully functional. The nerves to the voice box are going to be working just fine. We've removed this entire section of the trachea, and this part is mobile, and this part is mobile so that they can come together, and they're sewn together, and the patient has essentially this front part is closed, and the patient should be able to breathe without difficulty. And so this is what's removed, though, the cancer. So invasion of the larynx is a much more significant deal. That's what my patient just told you about has. He has something approximating this where the thyroid cancer has gone behind the thyroid cartilage, which is this is the Adam's apple, and starts invading and causing hoarseness, difficulty swallowing as well. And so you can remove part of the thyroid cartilage without removing the voice box, and that's this section. You can see this window of cartilage is removed. And then everything behind it is free of disease. And so the patient does not have to have their voice box removed. And that's what I'm hoping to accomplish with this patient. But in other cases where you have a much more significant invasion through the mucosa of the larynx and all the way around, you're not able to remove the whole You're not able to partially remove and save the voice box. You have to remove the whole thing. And what happens when you remove the whole voice box is you take the tissue from the thigh, make it into a tube, and that's a new conduit for swallowing. The trachea is brought out to the skin, so they breathe in and out of their neck here. I'm sure you guys, the patients, have seen that. In the past, they had this robotic electrolarynx voice. But nowadays, we can use what's called a TEP, or tracheoesophageal puncture, where we make a one-way, we put a one-way prosthesis from the trachea into the new esophagus and up, so that the patient just holds their hand here and air goes through their throat and mouth. Because the way you phonate, or the way you speak, is using your throat and lips more so than just your voice box. So you can recreate both swallow and speech, even though the patient has to face removing their voice box. And so this very clearly is a thyroid cancer all the way around the neck, essentially engulfing the neck and invading the voice box. And that comes out and looks like this. Another example. Yeah. Say again.
Is that what you would do with a waiter?
Well, so what I'm going to do at first is take him to the operating room and look into his voice box and esophagus and see if it's frankly invading. And this is usually a decision at when I take him to the operating room for the formal removal of thyroid cancer. It's a decision I would have to make then if we can remove the whole, save the larynx and remove the cancer safely versus having to take the whole voice box. And this is invasion of the esophagus, and that's pretty significant as well. And you can't remove the esophagus, which is below the voice box, without removing the whole voice box as well, which patients don't often understand. But and this is engulfment of the carotid artery. This is the thyroid cancer wrapping around the internal jugular vein, which is already taken, and it's 270 degrees around the carotid artery, which is this right there. So treatment for thyroid cancer, other forms. So after you've done your thyroid surgery, like I said before, you have to suppress the patient's TSH by giving them a high dose of levothyroxine. You give the patient radioactive iodine therapy where indicated, and I can talk about that later. External beam radiation therapy is often provided in patients who have significant local disease. And systemic therapy, which is also known as chemotherapy, is given for patients with distant metastasis. So just going on briefly to talk about medullary and anaplastic, these are much more rare cancers, but they're significantly impactful. Medullaries make up less than 5% of cancers. They arise in cells found at the top of the thyroid gland that are not the same cell follicle that I told you about before. These types of cancers arise from a cell that doesn't have a thyroid, an iodine transporter, so you can't treat them with radioactive iodine. So surgery is the mainstay for treatment for these. And like I said, these don't take up iodine, and so you can't treat them with radioactive iodine. They often involve lymph node metastasis, and the way you diagnose them, or the way you confirm them, is with a lab called calcitonin, and that's released by these cancers. 80% of these are sporadic, 20% are familial, so 20% actually come in these inherited syndromes, multiple endocrine neoplasia. These are syndromes that have medullary thyroid cancer and other types of issues like what's called a pheochromocytoma, which is this adrenal tumor which produces essentially adrenalines that run throughout your body, and they're associated with in syndrome called MEN2A, pheochromocytoma, hyperparathyroidism, which is growth of the parathyroids, which increases your body's calcium, and medullary thyroid cancer. And then you can also get MEN2B, which has these two, but also GI ganglioneuromas. Okay, so just brief synopsis on medullary thyroid cancer. Surgery is the primary treatment. They don't have radioactive iodine. They don't have these iodine transporters, so they can't receive radioactive iodine. You can't suppress them with TSH. And there's no role for radiation therapy and only systemic therapy in metastatic disease. Okay, anaplastic, just moving on, this final one. Anaplastic is probably one of the most aggressive malignancies known to man. So the most run-of-the-mill, least aggressive papillary thyroid cancer is probably one of the least aggressive cancers you can get next to a basal cell cancer of the skin, whereas an anaplastic thyroid cancer is one of the most aggressive cancers on Earth, and these are very, very aggressive. They carry roughly 95% mortality rate. So patients, these make up less than 5% of all thyroid cancers, but they account for 20 to 40% of thyroid cancer deaths. Death is usually from local invasion in the neck. Mean age of diagnosis is 65. They're rapidly growing, widely invasive, and they're thought to be from dedifferentiation, where basically a thyroid cancer, its cells internally morph into something much more aggressive that takes on a new rapid pace, and that leads the patient to present for help because they develop swallowing difficulty, hoarseness, or a large neck mass. This is what it would look like. You can just tell from looking at this alone. This is a cancer that's 360 degrees engulfing the patient's right carotid artery, expanding out through the neck. It's up to the skin. There's no barrier between the cancer and the skin here. Probably is out of the skin there. The larynx is in here somewhere. It's fully around the trachea. For some reason, it hasn't invaded the trachea at that point, and it's up to the vessels on this side. Another example here, the larynx is completely destroyed, and the cancer is growing out through the neck. And this is what's called a coronal viewer, looking straight on at the patient. This is a thyroid cancer that has already gone into the patient's trachea. It looks like it's blocking it here, but I'm sure it's not. This is esophageal invasion from an anaplastic thyroid cancer. So a synopsis for anaplastic thyroid cancer, there's really no effective therapy. There's only a role for surgery if it's safely resectable and completely resectable at the time of the patient's presentation. There's no role for debulking, which means removing 90 to 95% of the tumor and leaving only a little bit, because it's that little bit that comes back. And in weeks, the patient will have recurred from that little bit and would already cause invasion. So there's no effective therapy. A disease nearly universally fatal in over 95%, and patients survive roughly 3 to 7 months. Chief Justice William Rehnquist had this disease, and a lot of other notable people as well. And like I said, extensive local invasion, and patients, usually half patients, have distant metastasis at the time of initial diagnosis.
I don't understand distant.
Yeah, distant metastasis means has the disease spread to other parts of their body.
It can go to the kidneys?
Yep, it can go anywhere. Usually lungs, liver, and bone, but it can go pretty much anywhere. Kidneys is more rare, but it can. So surgery, like I said, is only indicated if complete resection is possible, and debulking offers no benefit. Whether you operate on a patient or not, really their survival over time is not great. And so the reason to operate and to offer surgery is because the patient is looking for hope and you think you can give it to them with the understanding that it's a rare patient who survives. Patients do survive, and a lot of patients hold out that hope that they can be the one or two that does. And so chemoradiotherapy is offered after surgery. We have a clinical trial at UCSF. This is the clinical trial where patients are given chemotherapy. They're given what's called a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which targets the cells on the thyroid cancer, as well as external beam RT, or radiation therapy. So in summary, thyroid disease can affect a lot of organ systems. Thyroid cancer can affect local structures in the neck. Both disease and cancer affects women more predominantly than men. There's no necessarily good cancer to have unless it's proven to be good through full evaluation. And thyroid disease and cancer can more commonly affect women. And women and men over 50, you should have your thyroid labs checked, get a physical exam, and have an ultrasound if it's needed. So thank you very much. We have some time for questions. If anybody has questions. Sir, we'll go clockwise. Go ahead, sir. Yeah, good question. So that's one of the first things you learn in training in otolaryngology, ENT training, or general surgery. So I'm going to repeat the question. The question is, where does a tracheotomy go with respect to all these structures in the neck? It goes either underneath or between the thyroid. So the thyroid isthmus, which is that little island in the middle, it can be opened without any effect on the thyroid gland, and or pulled up or down, and the tracheotomy would go below it. Yeah. And a patient who has a really significant thyroid gland enlargement doing a tracheotomy is often very, very risky, or is a significant issue that requires a lot of workup. Go ahead.
So
No, most of those are total thyroidectomy and have radioactive iodine and are following those patients with both of those procedures. The literature on recurrence after partial thyroid removal is more variable, and partly because their treatment is varied. So that you get part of your thyroid removed. And so if you have a small thyroid cancer, just to summarize it, I don't think I repeated your question. So I got to repeat your question, which is, in patients, in the studies I showed, do they reflect patients who had partial thyroid removal? And I said basically that those studies actually reflect total thyroid removal and postoperative radioactive iodine. The patients who have partial thyroid removal for a small tumor are a varied population. And so if you have a small thyroid cancer that's a centimeter and a half or smaller, you can have half the thyroid removed and then the other half would be observed. But you still have to have the same evaluation for surveillance. So you get a every 6 month ultrasound looking at the thyroid that was left in and then, of course, the neck lymph nodes. And there isn't a higher risk of recurrence for patients with small cancers for which you're able to get one, just the lobe removed. So there's not a higher risk of recurrence for those patients who have adequate surgery.
I have two questions. Is there any lifestyle, have they correlated any lifestyle reasons why people get?
So the question is there a lifestyle correlate to causes and contributors to thyroid cancer? There really isn't. So head and neck cancers, other types of cancers are smoking and drinking related, lifestyle related. This really is not. Family history and genetics are probably the highest linkage to a contributor, but there isn't a, and so of course radiation as well, like I said, but there's no a lifestyle contributor, diet, smoking, those may overall be associated with higher rates, but that's not necessarily causative, and so there's really no lifestyle cause. And you, the second question? Yeah. So the second question is, how does it present? Does it present as a abnormal lab value, or does it come as a neck mass or symptoms like hoarseness or swallowing function problems? And the truth, it doesn't present as lab abnormality. It usually presents as an asymptomatic, meaning no symptoms, physical exam finding by a primary doctor who finds a thyroid nodule. Some type of swelling in the neck, and then that leads to an ultrasound. That leads to an ultrasound-guided needle biopsy, and that bears a diagnosis of thyroid cancer. In more aggressive types of cancers, like the anaplastic and the medullary, anaplastic particularly, these present as essentially a chokehold on the neck from this rapidly progressive cancer-causing dysphagia, which is difficulty swallowing and breathing and voice problems.
If it's not diagnosed by lab, why get a lab for it?
Well, so the labs are really, so I have to repeat it. I keep not doing that. So the question is, if the cancer is not diagnosed by labs, then why do you follow labs? Labs are really overall is post-operative management of the thyroid cancer. So thyroid cancer, labs are not necessarily relevant up front. But afterwards, the most important labs are for surveillance, which is the thyroglobulin. If you have thyroid cancer removed and it's the whole thyroid taken out, your TG should go to zero or near zero. And that if it's come back, you may find it just in the lab value. The other diseases, hyper and hypothyroidism, those are really often labs are very helpful for those.
Could you explain how iodine works in terms of maybe being a prophylactic for any problems with
it? Yeah, good question. So the question is, can I explain how iodine can help prevent or help relate to prevention of thyroid disease and thyroid function? So the best thing I could say is that iodine is found in leafy green vegetables for the most part. Patients who don't have any of that in their diet may have less iodine. That doesn't mean you have to necessarily go get an iodine check, but keeping a balanced diet, eating things like kale, spinach, cabbage, whatnot, can give you enough iodine that you have enough thyroid hormone function. That doesn't necessarily relate to the prevention of thyroid cancer, because lack of leafy green vegetables doesn't necessarily cause thyroid cancer. But it can lead to normal thyroid function if you have those, if you take in those yummy substances. Did I answer your question?
You did. Now, in the old days, we had it in salt always, but now mm-hmm. we have it in sea salt.
Yeah, good question. Yeah. So iodinated salt gives you the iodine you need so that you can prevent this type of massive goiter that you get in endemic, you know, endemic goiter from regions where you have no iodine. So that's why we have iodine in our salt. Now, patients still use iodinated salt throughout the U.S. It's just that you're saying a lot of patients use sea salt, which is deiodinated. My guess is that they get enough iodine from their diet if they're using sea salt, meaning they get they're eating healthfully if they're already on the sea salt train.
Do you get iodine from fish?
I think fish do have iodine, but
no.
They don't. Can you? Did you say?
I was saying yes. Is there iodine in fish?
Oh, see, so the question is there iodine in fish? And I don't know. I'd have to invite a naturopathist or a dietitian, but I don't know. I mean, my guess is that that fish would have iodine in it, but not nearly as well known as the leafy green vegetables. Any other thoughts or questions? They may have. So the question is I had mentioned a study in Chicago, and this is a number of radiation misadventures where external beam radiation was used to treat the most minor conditions. Tonsillitis is not a significant condition. It's common, actually, but it doesn't necessarily lead to major morbidity, and radiation does. The question is, remind me the question, was there other... So is hyperthyroidism, was it ever treated with external beam radiation? I don't know. That may be true, and I'd have to look it up. So I don't know if it was. My guess is that it may have worked for a bit, and then 10 years down the road, the patient may have developed radiation-induced or associated cancers.
You said that there's a 95% survival rate, but then you said there's a 10 or 20% mortality rate for the same...
Oh, so... So 10-year survival for differentiated thyroid cancer as a whole is 95%, and that's partly related to... So the question is, I quoted a 95% survival rate for differentiated thyroid cancer, but then I said there's a 20% mortality rate, and I'd have to go back and look at the slide. So overall, as a whole, the differentiated thyroid cancer group, which is papillary and follicular, have a very high survival rate, roughly 95% of patients. That's really the highest survival is in young patients without disc metastasis. So those patients really have the 95% survival. Did I say that there's a 20% mortality rate? Now that I have to look back at the slide. So 5% of patients present with disc metastasis up front. And I don't recall that I have to go through the slide to see the 20% mortality rate. But mortality is usually from uncontrolled local disease. So if the disease isn't fully removed in the first surgery and it gets out of control, then that's usually what the local disease is from. Any other thoughts or questions? Okay, thank you guys all for coming out. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.